Good. Last week, we discussed the beginnings of Romanticism and the concept of the sublime. We had a look at how Romanticism was articulated in the visual arts, and we saw that it implied an emphasis on the irrational, the emotional, the overwhelming, that which cannot be controlled by reason. Furthermore, Romantic artists and thinkers had a preoccupation with the uncivilized, with popular culture like folklore and fairy tales, and with that which stood apart from Western civilization, such as, for instance, the exotic. Then I followed up on that introduction by discussing the Irish philosopher Edmund Burke. In particular, I talked about what he wrote about the sublime. This week, I will discuss the philosophical ideas of two poets from German Romanticism, and those are Friedrich Schiller in the first place and Heinrich von Kleist. That's the second one. Now, very briefly, the difference between these two people and Burke is that I called Burke like this pioneer of Romanticism who was not yet fully part of the movement of Romanticism, and that's not true for these two. So Kleist and Schiller are fully part of Romanticism. They are also of a much later. They're also much younger than Burke. They're from a later generation, and they're really working in the midst of the movement of Romanticism, which is especially strong in Germany. Okay, that being said, let me go over to my introduction about the figure of Friedrich Schiller, and then I will discuss his ideas in aesthetics, and then I will shift to Kleist. So, Friedrich Schiller is considered one of the most important Romantic poets in Germany. He lived from 1759 to 1805, and he is especially famous for the later period of his life. Why? He was then befriended with another famous German poet who you might have heard of, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, and together they were leading the theater in the city of Weimar. They did that together, and the interaction between the letters they wrote, the poems they wrote, each apart, the theater plays they wrote, how they managed the theater, all of that has become quite famous, has become known as Weimar Classicism, Weimar Klassik. I won't go too much into that. Now I want to look at the first period of Schiller's life. It's a time when he first became famous as a Romantic poet. Is the 1.5 decade just before, 1.5 last decade of the 19th century, of the, excuse me, the 1.5 last decade of the 19th century. And I'm not going to go too deeply into the relationship between his Romanticism and his period as a poet of Weimar Classicism, which is rather complicated, and it actually belongs to literary history more than to philosophy of art. As an example of this early period, you can look at Schiller's theater play, Die Räuber, The Robbers. It was published anonymously in 1781, had a very large success when it premiered in 1782, but it was also quite contested. It was quite controversial. It got him into some trouble, but that belongs more to the level of his biography, so I'm not going to go too deeply into that. And it is, what is more important to us is that it's the drama that heralded the literary movement known as Sturm und Drang. Sturm und Drang is what we call the early Romantic poetry and literature in Germany. It's a movement of literary renewal, and it arrived during the second half of the 18th century. The name Sturm und Drang is literally to be translated as storm and drive, and it's that by that it is meant inner drive, and it is taken from a play by Friedrich Maximilian Klinger from 1776. Now, the name in itself, Sturm und Drang, was characteristic for these new theatrical plays and for Romanticism in general. Why? Well, a very prominent feature of the new literature was the emotionality of it. The very extremes of emotion were given free expression by these poets, and that was a reaction to the perceived constraints of rationalism imposed by the Enlightenment. The spectator in the theater, or the reader at home, could now witness unusual, violent, even shocking outbursts of emotions on stage. The philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau was a great inspiration for the Sturm und Drang authors, and Rousseau is precisely famous for valuing the emotions above the capacities of human reason. Now let me go back to Schiller and to his first play, The Robbers. Why was it so remarkable? How do we see the emotions at play here? Well, the plot revolves around the conflict between two aristocratic brothers. Their names are Karl Moor and Franz Moor. They are the sons of the old Count von Moor. Karl is the oldest of the two brothers, and at the start of the play, he is a charismatic but rebellious student. He's making debts, and he wants his father to pay for those debts. And yet still, he is deeply loved by his father. The younger brother, Franz, on the contrary, is presented as a cold, calculating villain, and he strives to wrest away Karl's inheritance, because the inheritance normally would go to Karl, since he is the oldest of the two. I won't go very far into the plot, but the drama revolves around immoderate passions. That's the central motor of the plot. On the one hand side, you have Karl's urge for freedom, and on the other side, there is the boundless jealousy and hatred of Franz, which seems unmotivated. We don't get any explanation for why Franz is so sickly jealous. That's the key point. There is no real reason for him to be so hateful of his brother. He simply is hateful. And that was very uncomfortable for a late 18th century audience that had been trained on Enlightenment philosophy. I will come back to this, to the kind of drama that they were accustomed to and why romantic drama was so different from that. Okay, let's turn to the influence of these kinds of ideas on the romantic philosophy of art. What does romanticism mean for aesthetics? Well, Schiller is interesting in that regard because he mixes a number of ideas which are which belong to the Enlightenment, most notably the idea that you can educate an audience using art. And he mixes those ideas with a number of typically romantic preoccupations, namely that the emotions are exceptionally strong, stronger even than human reason, and might undo the very effort at educating an audience. So basically there is this tension here. What I would like to show you today is that there is a very notable tension in the work of Schiller in his ideas. And this is, there is some kind of paradox that he brings into the theory of aesthetics. I will look in particular at one essay that he has written, a philosophical essay about the theater. But before I come to that, let me recap what the Enlightenment meant for aesthetics. You will remember that we have two components in Enlightenment aesthetics, which are important. We have, on the one hand, a new rationalist aesthetics, for instance, neoclassicism in architecture. There you see it very clearly. And on the other hand, we have the increasing importance of subjective taste, which can deviate from the social norm imposed by neoclassicism. For example, see the Gothic castle of Horace Walpole. That's a very good example of it. You will notice that there is also a tension here, as I explained before. I will pass over that for that for the moment. Let me focus for now on the first component, a new rationalist aesthetics. We already saw what that could look like in the history of architecture, but what does it mean for the other arts, like the theater? Well, in line with the rationalist aesthetic, a number of thinkers, including Gotthold Ephraim Lessing in Germany, work out a theory of drama in which they emphasize the potential educational aspect of acting. And this is in line with the kind of plays that authors like Lessing are writing. For instance, let's have a look at Lessing's play called Nathan the Wise, and the original German title is Nathan der Weise. It was published in 1779. The play is a plea for religious tolerance. It is set in Jerusalem during the Third Crusade, and it describes how the wise merchant, a Jewish merchant, that's important, Nathan, succeeds in bridging the gap of cultural difference and religious difference with the leader of the Muslims, namely Sultan Saladin, and the leader of the Christians, namely the Templar. These three communities of belief, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, are embroiled in a conflict in Jerusalem, and Nathan finds a way out. A major topic of the play is tolerance and the need for communication. This is a typical Enlightenment outlook. Cultural and religious differences, the play tries to say, are not definitive. They do not have to divide human beings forever. Instead, these differences can be bridged, the conflicts can be resolved. Think also of the article in the Encyclopédie on Geneva by Jean d'Alembert, in which he had advocated to build a permanent theatre in the city. It would be good for public morals, is what d'Alembert says, and I quote, "The theatrical performances would form the taste of the citizens and would give them a fineness of tact, a delicacy of sentiment, which is very difficult to acquire without the help of theatrical performances." So all through Enlightenment aesthetics, we have this idea on the moral value of the arts. The arts can help us become better human beings. Now let me turn to the ideas of Friedrich Schiller. What we will see is that he builds further on these ideas, but there is also something else creeping into the argument, and that's interesting. Okay, I will discuss the ideas that he expounds in his essay called The Theatre Considered as a Moral Institution. Literally, that's the literal German title is Die Schaubühne als eine moralische Anstalt betrachtet. It was a lecture delivered on 26th of June 1784 to a learned society. And in the essay, Schiller starts from the question, what can a good permanent theatre actually achieve? Was kann eine gute stehende Bühne eigentlich bewirken? Now, the expression permanent theatre might sound strange to you, because is not any theatre a permanent theatre? No. This was not the case in early modern Europe, in 18th century Europe. During the 18th century, a theatre was still often performed on a temporary, improvised stage, just like in the Middle Ages. In the history of the theatre, you first have this period in Greek and Roman antiquity, where theatre is very popular, socially speaking. Then you have a period of decline. That's the Middle Ages. No new theatres are being constructed. Theatre going is not part of Christian culture. And then you have the early modern period, where theatre going is slowly becoming popular again, and more new theatres are being built. This is a slow process, and there is much debate going on. Even in large cities like Paris and London, where there had longer been permanent theatres, they were often the targets of moral and political censure. The venues where the plays by Shakespeare were performed were in the same district as the bars, the brothels, and the arenas for beer baiting and cockfighting. Theatres were seen as suspects. They were seen as an immoral form of entertainment. And the government actively censored plays. Religious authorities, Catholics and Protestants, all the same, fiercely criticized the theatre. Still, something was slowly changing. Just have a look at the size of theatres as an illustration of this. The first early modern theatres like the Globe Theatre in London, where Shakespeare performed his work, or the Hôtel de Bourgogne in Paris, where the work of Molière was performed, are quite small. They only offer space for, let's say, a few hundred spectators. There is almost no space behind the stage for stage props and other kinds of machinery or items of scenery. And this changes in the course of the 18th century. New theatre buildings are becoming bigger, much bigger. A good example is the theatre which was built in Lyon, in France, in 1754 by the architect Soufflot. It was later destroyed by fire, and a new theatre would be built on the same spot, which is now the Opera of Lyon. Now, the first theatre designed by Soufflot could house no fewer than 2,000 spectators. So that's a huge boost as compared to these early theatres with only a few hundred places. It also, the new theatre by Soufflot also had new features, like an underfloor level situated under the stage for stage machinery. The presence of these new, large theatre buildings was hotly debated among European intellectuals. Did we really need them? Why? Enlightenment philosophers believed they would benefit the arts and the general manners, and in this way they would benefit civilization in general. Critics Like Rousseau, on the other hand, believed that these projects were much too costly and that they could even harm public life instead of improving it. This is the very argument of his book, Letter to D'Alembert of 1758. Friedrich Schiller writes his essay more than 40 years later than Rousseau, but it's still the same debate. Actually, Germany is a bit behind on this European trend of theatre building. And what does Schiller add to the debate about the moral value of the theatre? Well, this is where it gets complicated, because a good number of Schiller's ideas are actually very close to the Enlightenment. For instance, he first defends the actors against the common prejudice that they were depraved individuals, that they were leading lives of luxury and sin and promiscuity. Especially actresses had a very bad name in this regard. They were often seen as almost equivalent to prostitutes. Schiller says, yes, this is a common prejudice, and I quote, this is Schiller talking. They say, your artists, how often are they not branded by the name they wear, or mere parodies of their sacred office? How often are they not the dregs of mankind? End of quote. True, says Schiller, this is the common prejudice, but it is totally unfair, because the actor actually has a moral function to serve. Actors are not bad for public morals, they can be good for public morals. How then? How does this happen? Well, the moral function that Schiller sees for actors might be summarized with one central quote from the essay. That quote goes as follows. Heilsame Schauer werden die Menschheit ergreifen. Salutary shudders will seize mankind. Salutary shudders will seize mankind. It's a beautiful sentence, but what does it mean? Well, salutary shudders means, yes, you can be horrified by what you see on the stage. You might shudder. Sometimes the theater shows us images and scenes that are quite horrible. Think of famous characters such as Macbeth and Lady Macbeth in Shakespeare. They plot to kill their own king, and then they become further and further embroiled in the consequences of their crime. They have to kill more and more people just to silence their own growing sense of paranoia. Actually, it's a bit like Scarface, the movie with Al Pacino, but then by Shakespeare. Or think of ancient Greek tragedy. For instance, the character of Medea, the princess of Colchis, who first falls in love with the Greek hero Jason, but then is betrayed by Jason and decides to murder her own children as an act of revenge against Jason. What the theatre does then is bringing us closer to these great criminals and downright evil characters. You might say that's not a very good thing in itself. Wait, let me quote Schiller on this. Monstrous criminals, long rotted to dust, are summoned by poetry's omnipotent call to relive their shameful lives for the grim edification of later generations. End of quote. Next quote. Someday, when morality is no longer taught, we shall still tremble as Medea totters down the palace steps. Fresh from the murder of her child, mankind shall be seized with healthy terror, and will silently rejoice over their own clear conscience as Lady Macbeth, the dreadful sleepwalker, washes her hands and summons all the perfumes of Arabia to extinguish the hateful odor of murder. Unconsciously, like empty shadows, the horrors of their own age pass before our eyes, while we, horrified yet fascinated, curse their memory. End of quote. Next quote. Consider now how religion and law are strengthened as they enter into alliance with the theater, where the human heart confesses its subtle stirrings while tortured on the rack of passion. End of quote. So Schiller's message is that the theatre can conjure up a terrifying image of certain crimes, which is far more powerful as a deterrent than laws or morals. And this in itself is a typical message of the Enlightenment. Yes, the theatre can show us horrible things, but what we see there will actually make us better human beings. We will learn from it. We will be deterred by what we see, by the crimes that we see there. Enacted in a fictional environment, which will make us better in real life. Now, the situation gets complicated. And that's when we turn to the second layer of Schiller's essay. That layer is to be found in the language that Schiller uses. The language, you could say, goes against the message. Schiller namely emphasizes the terrifying power of the irrational, and that brings his essay actually more in line with Romanticism than with the Enlightenment. Let me try to explain this in a bit more detail. On the surface of it, Schiller's argument sounds very rational. In the theater, you show people an image of abnormality, of crime, of incest, of murder, and the spectator reacts with horror. He or she is horrified yet fascinated. That's the expression he uses, horrified yet fascinated. I want to focus on this expression for a moment, because there is an ambiguity here, which also shows through in the other quotes. In the theater, it's about edification, yes, but about grim edification. We are confronted with people whose heart is tortured on the rack of passion. So the language of the emotions is very strong here. Schiller puts a lot of emphasis on the irrationality of the emotions. Ultimately, there should be a positive effect on morality. But in the meantime, a whole new tone has been set. A tone of the irrational, of the shower, the shudders, of the horror, entsetzen, being tormented on the rack of passion, etc. So implicitly, you could say, Schiller is already asking himself, are we going to be able to control these shudders? They are salutary shudders, healthy terror, but will we be able, as playwrights, as actors, as spectators, to control these emotions? Maybe the emotions are too strong for the lesson that has to be communicated. Schiller fully recognizes the destructive force of the irrational, and instead of pure rationalism, he rather provides the reader with a rationalization of that which is beyond reason. There is a tension in his essay between the discourse of the Enlightenment and the discourse of Romanticism. Okay, now let's take this same logic, the logic of Romanticism, emphasizing the emotions against the predominant belief in human reason, and go in a different direction. Let me present another German poet and playwright from the same period to you, namely Heinrich von Kleist. He was a bit younger than Schiller. He was born in 1777. He died quite soon, at a quite young age, in 1811. In his own time, Kleist was especially known for his comedies and for his historical dramas. An example of his comedies is Das Käthchen von Heilbronn, Kate of Heilbronn, 1808. And a very famous example of his historical dramas was Die Hermannschlacht, The Battle of Arminius, 1809. Kleist, for a very long time, was regarded as an important national poet for Germany because some of the ideas which he presented in his plays, and most notably in the Hermannschlacht, proved very influential on emerging German nationalism. But that's not a topic on which I want to focus today. Rather, I would like to turn to his fascinating essay on the puppet theater. It's from 1810, and it remains a particularly original product of Romantic thought. At a time when rationalism was still dominant, Kleist asked a question that was diametrically opposed to Enlightenment philosophy. What if rationality and consciousness were not to help the arts, but rather just got in the way? Okay. Kleist develops this question in a dialogue between two visitors of a puppet theater. The narrator of the dialogue enters into a conversation with a famous dancer, whom he has often seen visiting a small puppet theater in the center of town. And together they attempt to understand their shared fascination with the puppets. Why are the puppets of the puppet theater so graceful? Why do these two men, who are both adult men, they're not supposed to go to a puppet theater, but still they are there. Why are these puppets so graceful? What makes them so beautiful, so fascinating? Was it possible that the puppets gave such a graceful impression, the dancer asks, because they were not equipped with rational thinking? And this is the line of reasoning that they will start to follow. The puppet was so graceful, the two men argue, because it performs its movements entirely automatically. If the puppet would ever become aware of its own movements, it would lose all of its grace. Just like an animal, actually. And at that moment of the conversation, Kleist has the dancer tell an anecdote about a fencing bear. As a guest of a nobleman in Latvia, in Northern Europe, the dancer had encountered a bear raised on the family estate, and the animal is very skilled at fencing with people, using just his paws, just his... And the dancer, who is himself a talented fencer, has to test the skills of the bear. Okay. So the dancer takes out his sword and strikes the bear with his sword. The bear makes an extremely short movement with his paw and parries the stroke. He deflects it. Now the dancer tries again and again. He tries to confuse the bear with feinted attacks. It's no use. The animal doesn't move. At the end of the duel, the dancer is dripping with sweat, and the bear, like the best fencer in the world, can parry all of his attacks. But he does never react to feints. After telling this anecdote, the dancer goes one step further. He generalizes his experiences to a philosophical conclusion. And I quote, "As contemplation becomes darker and weaker in the organic world, so the grace that is there emerges all the more shining and triumphant. Grace returns after knowledge has gone through the world of the infinite, in that it appears to best advantage in that human bodily structure that has no consciousness at all, or has infinite consciousness. That is to say, in the mechanical puppet or in the god. Hence, human reason, human consciousness is not only a gift, it is also a curse. The puppet's gracefulness is precisely due to the fact that it, just like an animal, just like the ideal dancer, performs its movements automatically and thoughtlessly." I think this philosophical question is actually still highly relevant today. Does grace indeed consist of the absence of consciousness? It sounds like a seductive point of view. Everybody has had this experience of making a happy movement while dancing or while doing sports, and afterwards, with all the effort in the world, you cannot repeat that movement. Whatever you try, that graceful sway, that acrobatic kick will not come out. Only the grace of the moment, so to speak, the absence of thinking, has made it possible. The problem is, if you would want to generalize from that experience, you also have to accept the dramatic consequences of Kleist's position. The absence of consciousness also means the absence of freedom. The bear reacts perfectly to the attacks of his opponent because he cannot react differently. The puppet is perfectly graceful because it cannot do anything else but obey the movements of the puppet master. Another problem is the strong religious connotation of Kleist's view. Think of the language he uses. Grace appears best in the mechanical puppet or in the god. That's a quote. It is no coincidence that grace is a word from the arts, but also from religion. So the absolute absence of consciousness in the puppet appears to touch the divine summum of consciousness. And the suggestion is that it is precisely a divine puppeteer who controls the puppet's art, a higher power that literally pulls the strings. This brings me to the topic of artistic unfreedom in the arts today. Do we still worry about grace, about the ideal of graceful movements? Is it still relevant to us? Well, most certainly. Think of ballet, think of contemporary dance, think of circus, think of other performing arts, and not to forget the graceful movements in sports. So when we talk about artistic freedom in the arts today, especially in the performing arts, it is at least worth asking, whose freedom? The artist can be free while at the same time denying all freedom to his collaborators. Think of the strict discipline that reigns in classical ballet. It is the dancer who dances, but it is the choreographer who dictates his or her movements. Or think of the demanding training program for the acrobatic bodies of the circus. The performing stage artist, such as the ballerina or the circus acrobat, accepts a high degree of artistic unfreedom. How can we reconcile that with our modern ideal of artistic freedom? Now, I will leave you with this question today. Please continue to reflect on it. Maybe it can be useful, or maybe it can be the start of an item in your philosophical portfolio. Don't forget to read the chapter in the book, to have a look at the slides. There's not so many this time. And don't forget to take the test online. Thank you.